We're in Mark chapter 16. Joseph of Arimathea has just stuck his neck out, sociologically speaking, I guess I should say, in order to honorably bury Jesus. Joseph of Arimathea was sacrificing the honor that he had with his fellow Jewish elite. He's sacrificing any sort of clout that he could have possibly had with the Roman elite in order to give Jesus this honorable burial, where he takes his own tombstone, his own tomb, and not tombstone, his own tomb, and buries Jesus honorably within it. The women were standing by, the women that were actually at the tomb of Jesus, or at the crucifixion of Jesus, at a distance in Mark's gospel. They see where Joseph of Arimathea is at. Two of them do, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, which you see in verse 47. And we're going to see them now reemerge as the key figures of the rest of the Gospel of Mark. Mark chapter 16, verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, so what time are we at? 6 o'clock Saturday. Because the Sabbath goes from 6 p.m. on Friday to 6 p.m. on Saturday. So after 6 o'clock on Saturday, on the Sabbath, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. So you have the Sabbath day that's occurring for the 24-hour period that we had written up here. You can vaguely see it from yesterday. They go and buy the spices on this evening in order to go to the tomb the following morning. So it's not enough to say, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Very early, verse 2, very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, oh, who will roll away the stone from the entrance of the tomb? I find that a bit humorous. We do this a lot in our own lives. But man, they're focusing on, you know, getting preparation of all the different spices and herbs they're going to need to make sure that he gets the honorable burial, to make sure he's dressed right, maybe even kingly-like. They wait till the Sabbath. They've done all the preparations for the Sabbath day. Once the Sabbath's over, then they go to do more preparations. Then they're actually on the way to the tomb. And that's when it occurs to them. Oh, man. How are we even going to get in? It's kind of like whenever I'm counseling people that are about to get married. And I have to look at them. Usually, at least once, every time I'm counseling somebody that's getting married, I look at them and say, man, you're focusing a lot on the wedding day and you're not really focusing on the marriage at all. You're preparing for the day you're going to get married, but you're not preparing for the day after. You haven't really thought this all through yet. There's some things you need to do in order to actually have a successful marriage, and very little of it has to do with what flowers you're picking out for that day you get married. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's insignificant. But what I'm saying is, proportionately speaking, I would think that you'd be focusing more on the marriage than the day, but we normally don't do that. We do that in Christian life all the time. We spend our time focusing on so many of the things that are going to prepare us, maybe like the piety rules, where we actually never even get to living out the lifestyle. Make sure you're not running to the tomb with all the preparations and you think, how are we even going to get in? Because when you do that, people will laugh at you because it seems ridiculous. And yet we do it all the time. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, oh, who's going to roll away the stone? I'm not big enough. You're not big enough. This is going to be a problem. But verse 4, but when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled away. Initially, do you think they're thinking, miracle? No. It's probably just mass confusion, bewilderment. What's happening? Did somebody come here to dress, to bring the herbs already? Are we not the first ones to think of this? It was very early in the morning when we came. Or something worse happened? Did somebody desecrating his body? Have the Jewish elite decided to do more to the already shamed body of Jesus? What's happening here? Natalia. I can't totally hear you because of the wind. Can you speak up just a little bit more?
I thought the stone from the tomb can't be moved after it's been sealed.
Oh, no, it can be moved. It's just that it's not an easy task to accomplish. It would have to be able to be moved at some point because these tombs wouldn't have been just for one person. It's a family tomb. As a matter of fact, the tombs were an inheritance that you'd pass down throughout your family, so all of your family could be buried inside of this type of a tomb. So the when the stone going in front, the purpose is to seal it tight, but it could be moved. It would just take a great amount of force to actually move it. Okay.
Like, I don't know. They just seem pretty like flippant. Oh, we can go in and out.
Yeah, the women probably were not privy to the conversation with the Jews and the Romans. They probably, whenever they saw Joseph of Arimathea burying Jesus before the Sabbath, the Roman guards were not there.
Okay.
So whenever they're coming 2 days later or a day and a half later, they're not expecting to see much different. What is in the middle of grief and in the middle of their preparation and in the middle of all of the emotional array that goes with losing someone like Jesus. Moving the tombstone probably was not on the top of the priority list in their mind. So it, really, more than anything, the historical narrative is probably describing the emotional state of the women, like anybody. And I'm not saying it's just women, it's anybody. If you've ever had anyone that's passed away, especially that's close to you, thinking rationally is not something that normally comes very easy in those moments. It just doesn't. Because you're just trying to figure out which way is up. And so you'll do stupid things. And one of the key stupid things that just happens to get recorded in history that we've been reading for 2,000 years now is they forgot to figure out who was going to open the tomb. The tomb could be opened. It would just take a large amount of force. And three women probably would not have been able to accomplish that. A matter of fact, it probably would have even been tough for three men. But that's a whole other issue. Any other questions before we keep moving? That's good. I want to make sure you guys are all following. We have time to make sure you're all on the same page. Okay? Right. Yes.
Do you think that maybe the fact that like his family was going to be buried with Jesus is part of the reason why Joseph and Arimathea wanted to bury Jesus in his tomb?
Say that again.
Do you think that part of the fact was that like his family would be buried with him is why Joseph and Arimathea wanted to bury Jesus in his tomb?
Whose family would be buried with him?
More
than likely, Joseph of Arimathea. Here's what's probably happening. The statement by Joseph of Arimathea whenever he takes Jesus and puts him in his family tomb, more than it is that Joseph of Arimathea is excited he's going to be close to Jesus, who at the time he buries him was a crucified political revolutionary that had a failed messianic run. Joseph of Arimathea is in essence saying, I still consider you part of my family. So more than an honorable thing for Joseph of Arimathea, this was a shameful thing for him. But he was saying, in spite of what's been convicted, I still consider you a part of my family. Does that answer your question some? Okay. So really, it's not just a risky political move for Joseph of Arimathea. It's a very intimate move of Joseph of Arimathea, saying, I still consider you my brother, my dad, I don't know what the relationship would be, but family. Yeah. Good question. All right. But when they looked up, verse 4, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. Well, that's convenient. Maybe. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. The word alarmed there is pretty interesting. The last time that we saw the word alarmed, this word was in Mark chapter 14, verse 33. After the Lord's Supper, Jesus takes to the Garden of Gethsemane, and the text says, Jesus took Peter, James, and John along with them, and he began to be alarmed, or deeply distressed and troubled. Why do I think Mark uses this same word? Matter of fact, this word will be used one more time, and it's in verse 6, whenever the young man looks at him and says, don't be alarmed. Why is he using that? Because I think what he's trying to show is that what has happened before the cross and now what is happening after are mirroring each other. Because ultimately, that which brought Jesus alarm is that which brings Jesus victory. Why? Because in the cross, well, that's how we win. They were alarmed. Verse 6. Don't be alarmed. I love that God says that to us so much in the Bible. I love that. Man, I love that. Because there's just a lot of stuff in this world to be alarmed about. I don't know if this will sound pathetic or not, but that's okay. Usually for my lunch, I give myself about 10 to 15 minutes I sit in my office, have my peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I pull up all the Yahoo headlines, all the ESPN headlines, and all the Huffington Post headlines I want to read. And I just read through them. And I finally just had to stop doing that about a week or two ago. Because, man, I was just getting depressed by reading all the stuff that's going on. Whether you're in the sports section or whether you're in the Yahoo section or the Huffington Post section, there is some sort of sexual allegation that's occurring. There's some sort of molestation account that's happening. I mean, it's so sickening that I just had to stop. And it alarms me because I've got three kids. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my goodness. Lord, what would I do if one of my kids was a part of one of these headlines? Like, well, matter of fact, I have a friend that he doesn't want to have kids at all because he's just afraid of bringing kids into this world. And there's a part of me that I totally get that. I do. I really understand his heart in that and his fear in that. But if you're constantly calculating every move that you make based on fear, man, you're just not going to really go anywhere. You're not going to really be able to take the gospel really many places at all. God's really going to have not a whole lot of use for you if fear is what drives you. Fear is a powerful thing. Fear is what drives money. You want to make a lot of money? Create a product that people have to have in order to alleviate their fear. You want to get elected to an office? Be the one that has the answers to all the different accounts of fear that you're spreading around. Fear is a powerful tactic, one that Satan knows very well and he uses very well. And consistently, over and over and over and over and in the Bible, it says, God says, don't fear. Matter of fact, what's ironic is that God says, don't fear, but the Bible also says, fear God. For the beginning of all wisdom is fearing God. Why would I fear God? Because he really can deliver on everything that is atrocious, because he has that power. And yet the one that has that power looks at you and says, but you've got nothing to fear. Because you're with me. I almost feel like when we're in chapter 16, it's appropriate to start repeating some of the sentimental devotional moments that we've had throughout the semester. Because they all come to a head here in the empty tomb. They all come to a head here, where history and faith and mystery and certainty all collide. And in that moment, you have a little guy with a white robe that's kind of glowing, looking at you saying, hey, don't be alarmed, everything's good. As a matter of fact, he tells us why. You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene, the same designation that the little girl accusing Peter just a couple of chapter and a half earlier used about Jesus. You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. Yeah, we are, but he is risen. He is not here. See, look for yourself. See the place where they laid him? But I want you to go and tell his disciples and Peter. Whoa. Why did he say it like that? Yeah, you got to remember the last time. Who is the mind behind this gospel? Man. You can hear Peter almost crying as he's telling Mark. He said, and they told me the angel said my name. Oh, they told me the angel said my name. Just a couple of chapters earlier, Jesus of Nazarene was connected with a moment that I wish I could take back more than anything. Whenever a little slave girl asked me, do you know him? And I said, I never even heard of him. I will take an oath. I will deny him. I will call curses down on myself. I don't know him. And then I remember hearing the rooster crowing. But the angel said my name. The angel said my name. And this guy that's giving us really the words of the Gospel of Mark is the same guy that will be the one that gives the words of the kingdom of God on Pentecost. The same guy that denied Jesus three times. The same guy that in John, Jesus will look at him and say, do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? feed my sheep. Three times. The threes are pretty interesting whenever you link them all together inside the life of Christ. Three times he's tempted by Satan. Three times Jesus in the garden asked for God to take the cup away. Three times Peter denies him. Three times Jesus reinstates Peter. All of it's to say this. It doesn't matter how far you run away, you can still run back. And the amazing thing about Jesus is he just never leaves. It's like I was mentoring a guy, this was several years ago, and he just decided one night just to leave. Leave town, go back, just start boozing and just do whatever he wants. Didn't ask me, didn't tell me. I didn't find out until really a day later that he was back in his hometown, just gone back to his lifestyle. And it was about a month later over the next week of stuff, I was just, all I would text him was, I love you. I love you. About a month or so later, he texted me and he said, it's been several weeks. I could tell he was drunk by the way he was texting. He says, why don't you care for me anymore? And I really wrestled for like 20 minutes of what to text back. I didn't know what to say. And finally, I just said the thing I felt like Jesus says to me all the time. And that is, bro, I never left. I'm always here. And if he'd come back even right now, I'd take him in my arms and say, I'm glad you're back. And that's Jesus. And Peter knows that better than anybody. Because the angel says his name. Man, that had to have been sweet. But go, tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. When did Jesus tell them that he was going into Galilee? Think hard. Cheat if you have to. Flip back. Look for it. When did Jesus say he's going back into Galilee? It's in Mark, I promise. It's even been recent. Anyone? Mark chapter, yeah, Martin? Chapter 14, verse 28. Where are we in chapter 14, 28? Peter's denial. Well, kind of. It's right after what event? What? Right after the Lord's Supper, when Jesus says, hey, the way we're going to establish this a kingdom is through a cross. That's how we're going to do it. Through a cross. Matter of fact, verse 27 then says, and let me just tell you, whenever the cross comes down, all of you are going to abandon me. And then he says, but after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. The angel's reminding them of the message of hope right in the middle of the prediction of Jesus' death to let them know that victory has been attained, just like Jesus said. How is it attained? Through the cross, because that's how we win. He's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. And all of a sudden, the Gospel of Mark is climaxing to the moment of jubilation. The Gospel of Mark has been building all to this moment where now the victory that Jesus has been talking about through his death is going to happen. Because now we're going back to Galilee. And then verse 8 comes. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. What? How can we end the message of the Gospel of Mark like that? Well, maybe it doesn't end, Shane. Didn't you know there was verses 9 through 20? Glad you brought that up. Let's read verses 9 through 20. Okay? Verses 9 through 20. I'm just going to read them straight. Then we're going to talk about them. We're going to talk about a couple of things. First of all, I want you to ask the question, what if Mark did end his gospel in verse 8? But let's act like that's not there yet. Let's just read verses 9 through 20. When Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene. Oh, we've seen her so far, haven't we? How many times have we seen her so far? Her name has been mentioned three times in just the past 25 verses. He appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven demons. She went and told those who had been with him and who were mourning and weeping. When they heard that Jesus was alive and she had seen him, they did not believe it. Afterward, Jesus appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking in the country. These returned and reported it to the rest. But they did not believe them either. Later, Jesus appeared to the 11 as they were eating. He rebuked them for their lack of faith and their stubborn refusal to believe those who had seen him after he had risen. He said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the good news to all creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name, they will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands. And when they drink deadly poison, it will not hurt them at all. They will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well." After the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven, and he sat at the right hand of God. Then the disciples went out and preached everywhere, and the Lord worked with them and confirmed his word by the signs that accompanied it. Let me say this. Man, verses 9 through 20, good story. It actually somewhat alleviates some of the weirdness of verse 8. But there's a little phrase I didn't read that's in between verse 8 and verse 9 in my Bible. What does it say? Is it in yours? If you have KJV, it will not be in yours. What does it say? The earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16, 9 through 20. So again, I ask the question, what if Mark ended his gospel in verse 8? Before we answer that question, we need to look at the longer ending. The ending in verse 8, I will say, seems a bit ridiculous. Why does it seem ridiculous, the end of verse 8? State the obvious if you need to, but why does it seem a bit ridiculous? It's a terrible way to end the book. Why? Because what? They run away in fear. It even specifically says they tell no one. They don't tell anyone. You're going to end your gospel with the only people that have witnessed the resurrection running away, confused, scared, trembling, and not telling anyone. That just begs for more of an ending. So what could have possibly have happened? Some people suggest that maybe the end of the scroll was damaged at verse 8. That's why we don't have it in the earliest manuscripts. As a result, verses 9 through 20 was probably somebody remembering how it ended, and therefore it should be authentic. Whatever. A similar explanation is that maybe the last couple of pages were lost. I don't think the person that suggests that understands exactly how scrolls work, but that's okay. The idea is that maybe we don't have the ending because something happened in the transmission of the actual manuscript. Another explanation is maybe the author impediment. Maybe the author was intending, Mark was intending to end it, but he was killed before he could end it. Or, like what a lot of people say to me, they say the KJV doesn't have a break between 8 and 9, so since it was sent straight from heaven, why are you questioning it at all? I've heard all of these and I understand them. But they actually have better arguments. Let me give you some more of the longer ending arguments against ending in verse 8. Number one, they will almost always say, you cannot end a book with gar. If I end in verse 8, the last word of Mark's gospel is for, gar, in the Greek. And they say, what kind of an ending is that? That's ludicrous. You can't end a book with gar. Number two, they say that the early church was so focused on resurrection appearances that would not only be odd for Mark to end without resurrection appearances, but it is problematic at best. He's got to have the resurrection appearances, otherwise the story is not complete. And number three, and I agree with this one, it is a bit odd, they say, if the ending of the book occurs in verse 8, now hang with me in all these details because we're going somewhere with this. And actually, I think this is one of the most powerful application points in the book of Mark, and we're going to get there through textual criticism, believe it or not. New Testament intro is valuable on some level. That if we end in verse 8 of chapter 16, the Gospel of Mark ends with disobedience. That's weird. At best, that's weird. So now let me just say, I hear the arguments. I even share the sentiment. Let me propose a possible solution of why I do think the book of Mark ends in verse 8. Number one, and this shouldn't surprise you, I'm going back to what we talked about for the first week and a half of school. What was happening at the time in which Mark was writing his gospel? What is the dates of this book that we landed on? Say it again. Around anywhere from 68 to 70. What's happening at that time period? What's that? At that time, yeah, Nero's about to die. Galba's going to take over at the end of 68. Then in 69, you're going to have Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian all ruling. They're fighting over the title Son of God. In the midst of this, though, we're coming right off of 64. 64, whenever Nero, inside of Rome, which is the place to where Mark was written, Nero was lopping off Christians because he blamed them for the burning of the city. So much so that Tacitus even says the way he was killing him, the frequency with which he was killing him, started making even those that hated those people the stupid superstition. They even started to pity the Christians because of what was happening to them. 65 through 68, you see the deaths of Paul. You see the death of Peter. Christians at the time Mark is writing are in a time of great turmoil. For in 66, something else happens. The Jewish people begin to rebel. And the Christians, a lot of times, get lopped into the mobbing that's happening against the Jews because the Jews and the Christians are considered almost one and the same. They've got their religious differences, but they're still a Jewish sect. What's happening at the time this book's being written? Christians are in intense, I want to say the word persecution, but I don't want you to equate that to killing. There were some killing, but they're in a moment of deep tension. They're in a moment of deep duress. That will be important because of the way in which I think he ends this, but we'll come back to that in a minute. Let me first respond to some of the exegetical things that they suggest. First of all, the supposed problem of ending a book with gar is just silly. We actually do have books that end with gar-like phrases very abruptly. Even the Odyssey ends in a very abrupt manner to the point where you could accuse the Odyssey of not fulfilling its duties of a book. You can't end a book like that. As a matter of fact, even if you look throughout the book of Mark, this ending abruptly with gar even seems to be a literary style of Mark throughout the book. Mark chapter 6, 45 through 52 ends very similarly. 14, 1 through 2, similarly. 9, 30 through 32. 12, 13 through 17. The gar ending, even the abrupt ending, prepositional phrases, seems to be more of a literary style of Mark than an anomaly at the end of his book. Therefore, I also find it a bit difficult to look at someone and say, you shouldn't have ended your book that way. It's saying you shouldn't have ended, I'm not comfortable with you ending your book that way, is one thing. But it's a totally other thing to say, because I'm not comfortable with it, therefore he could not have done it that way. That's ridiculous. Second thing I would say, there are arguments against verses 9 through 20 that I think are pretty much damning for the whole pericope. Number one, we have a major switch in the subject from 16:8 to 16:9. For 16:8, the subject is very clearly the women. 16:9, it automatically just abruptly shifts to Jesus. What's difficult about that for me is that the name Jesus never appears in verse 9 in the Greek. It's not there. The reason why we insert the name Jesus there is because it starts talking about the one that resurrected. And so it uses the word resurrected, and we assume, well, it can't be talking about the women. It must be talking about Jesus now, so we have to insert his name. The switch in the subject without the Greek even telling us there's a subject that's about to be switched is a bit difficult between 16:8 and 16:9. Number two, Mary Magdalene in 16:9 is kind of strange. What did you notice weird about Mary Magdalene in 16:9? She's reintroduced. Jesus rose, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven 7 demons. How many times have we talked about Mary Magdalene so far? This is we've talked about her 3 times before, this is the 4th time. And now he's going to put this qualifying indicator of who she is, he cast out demons from her. Why didn't you say that back earlier, whenever she was very first mentioned? It's a bit strange. Why the oddity? Why the discontinuity? Why the tension? Furthermore, I am very compelled by the textual, by the manuscript evidence. Our earliest and best manuscripts, the ones that are the most reliable, like Aleph and B, I mean, some really important ones, do not even have an inkling of verses 9 through 20. It's just not there. The earliest and best do not have them. As a result, that's a major question mark. As a matter of fact, you also have other different church fathers like Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Jerome, don't even have a clue that there's a longer ending. Now, some do, like Irenaeus does mention that there could be a different ending, but he says it is not written by Mark. So even the early attestations of a longer ending, the people are bringing it up to say that we don't even believe he wrote it. Also, we have varying traditions. The longer ending of verses 9 through 20 is not the only tradition we have at the ending of verse 8. After verse 8, we also have what is not in the KJV, but that is in a lot of our manuscripts, what they've called 16:8b, the last half of 16:8, which says, "But they reported briefly to Peter and those with him all that they had been told. And after these things, Jesus himself sent out through them from east to west the sacred and imperishable proclamation of eternal salvation. Amen." So it's not the only ending that we have. We have more than one. But both this shorter ending, the intermediate ending, the 16:8b, as well as 9 through 20, both do one thing. They try to alleviate the tension that would be left with the women, fear and trembling and telling no one. That's their goal. Another reason why I don't really buy into 9 through 20 is because the vocabulary is off the charts different. Both the syntax, the way in which the words are put together, as well as even the words that are being used are very not Markan. In these 12 verses, we have 17 brand new Greek words to the book of Mark that are used 21 times. Now, I'm not saying he's not allowed to use any new words. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that many in that short of a space lets me know that this may not be exactly who it was that was writing earlier. As a matter of fact, there are two words that are even homoeteutons. They're not even used in the New Testament at all. So, when I take all of this evidence, I once again come back to the question, okay, what if then Mark ended in 16:8? Why? Why would he do that? I think the answer is the answer to the messianic secret. What we've been talking about, and I kept teasing you saying, we'll talk about the last day. We're going to talk about it. Messianic secret's been a key theme throughout Mark, has it not? William Redd, at the end of the first quest for the historical Jesus, uses the messianic secret in Mark to show that Mark has a literary pattern. Mark clearly is a literary work. It's not that it's anti-historical, just that within its history, it is also bringing literary devices, specifically the messianic secret. In the messianic secret, over and over, what you see is you see Jesus healing people, or his identity being revealed, like to Peter. And then what does he say? What does Jesus always say after his identity has been revealed to someone? Don't go tell. Don't tell anyone. What's intriguing about that is whenever the disciples are told not to tell anyone, they obey Jesus. Because Peter doesn't go tell anyone. The inner three don't tell anyone after transfiguration. They just don't. But you see with the people that are healed, the lepers, what do they consistently do? Disobey. Don't they? They disobey. They're told not to tell, and what do? They go tell. But they're not the ones that are supposed to be the ones out telling. They're not even the actual disciples of Jesus. They're just ones that walked into this and they love him so much for what he has done. And now they may be a follower of Jesus, but they are not a capital A apostle. And whenever they're told, don't tell, they go tell. And now, one of the first times that the disciples, a direct disciple of Jesus, is told, go tell, what do? They don't tell. He looks at him, the messianic secret is flipped. He says, go tell someone. And they run away, fear and trembling, not saying anything. Here's what I think Mark's doing. I think you get the end of his gospel, and all of a sudden you realize verse 8, more than an odd ending, is a mirror in which the Christians in the first century are staring back at themselves saying, what have I been told to do? In the middle of Rome crashing down all around me, whenever the concept of carrying my own cross is very real, I know I've been told to go tell. And I'm not. I'm disobeying, but in the wrong way. For every time Jesus told them not to tell, they went and told. And now he's told me to tell. And I know the truth about the resurrection. I know the truth about the crucifixion. I know what he's done for me. And I'm not telling. Mark looks at him and he says, if these women didn't go tell, what would have happened? Because one of the questions that comes to my mind is, when you get to where they walk away, run away, fear and trembling, and telling no one, I sit there and I go, then how is anyone going to know about the resurrection? And Mark looks at his audience and he says, exactly. If you don't go tell, how will anyone know about the resurrection? I know the world's going crazy. I know you're tempted to just walk away fear and trembling and telling no one. I know you are. But if you don't tell, who will? You get to the end of Mark, and what appears to be a weird ending is actually the biggest kick in the face. Because he says, do you remember how I started off this book? Boldly, with the most political verse in the entire New Testament, boldly proclaiming that Jesus is the King. And after the resurrection, you walk away fear and trembling? What does he need to do to get you to go tell? What does he need to do? If the women acted the way that you acted, you would have never known. So go tell. Man, you get to the end of the book and you realize there's a finger pointing out at you saying, you think the story's ended? It does if you don't go tell. And I know a lot of scribes why they would have tried to add a longer ending. Because there's such a tension at the end of Mark. But I don't want to get rid of that tension. I want that tension to haunt me. I want that tension to haunt you. Because if you don't go tell, how will they know? I love you guys.